When you speak of the criminal justice system, certainly America has the most people under lock and key in the whole world.
That's right.
And, of course, blacks lead the category, I guess, in the number of people in prison. Just recently, they had in New York a fellow by the name of Jazz Hayden, who instituted a lawsuit to get his voting rights back. Many people have lost their voting rights because of being ex-felons. How does the criminal justice system or black involvement in the criminal justice system play on the move towards a more democratic society or a less democratic society?
In The Great Wells of Democracy, I have a chapter entitled Facing the Demon Head On. And it comes from an experience I had at Sing Sing Prison. When you go to Sing Sing, there's a big sign that overlooks the entrance of the prison. This is a prison, by the way, that was first established in 1817, nearly 200 years ago. More people have been executed in Sing Sing Prison than any prison or any penitentiary on the North American continent. Nearly 1,000 people have been executed at that site. You walk in and there's a huge sign over the door that says, "Through these doors pass the finest corrections officers in the world." I walked in. I was stunned. I instantly thought of the sign over Auschwitz, "Work makes us free." I asked Bill Weber, who has run for 20 years New York Theological Seminary's MA program in Sing Sing, and I said, "What do you think of the sign, Bill?" He said, "Demonic." Well, a young Latino man, Tony, a 35-year-old brother who was in prison in the MA program, said, yes, Manning, it is demonic, but it is time to face the demon head on. In my chapter, Time to Face the Demon Head On, I talk about all of the collateral consequences of mass incarceration. The chief consequence is what I call civil death. You heard of civil rights? There is now, today, civil death. That is, the destruction of people's capacity to play real roles in civil society. The loss of the right to vote. Hundreds of jobs throughout this country. More than 100 jobs in New York State, but through state legislation, are prohibited from people with a felony record. Now, this is not just African Americans, even though, of course, 1 million African American women and men are currently incarcerated in federal and state prisons throughout the United States in county jails. Keep in mind that there are 2 million people in prison. On any given day, 5.4 million Americans, black, Hispanic, and white, and Asian, are locked up or in some aspect of the prison industrial complex. There are 600,000 people who come out of prison every single year. 22% of all Americans have a criminal record. That's right. More than 1 in 5 Americans has a criminal record. You can't lock up millions and millions of people and not have a devastating economic and political impact across the country because of mass incarceration. Take a look at the election in Florida that was stolen in 2000. Over 300,000 African-American citizens of the state of Florida were not allowed to vote, even though they pay taxes, even though they're working hard, even though they are citizens of this country and they are not allowed to vote. There are 4.65 million Americans, of whom 1.75 million are African-Americans who cannot vote in this country. And so I show in The Great Wells of Democracy the devastating impact against democracy of mass incarceration and the prison industrial complex.
Manning, speaking of death, you talked about the death of the talented 10th. How did they die, and is a rebirth an historical necessity?
Nope. That's a short answer to the second question. Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois wrote an essay in 1904 entitled, that focused on the issue of the talented 10th. And he argued that from a race-based standpoint, African Americans of the middle class, professionals, doctors, lawyers, teachers, had the obligation of lifting up their brethren, their sisters and brothers, who were illiterate, who lived in the rural South. You got to remember that half of all African Americans were illiterate at the end of the 19th century, that 90% of us lived in the rural South. that most of us did not have access to college or university education or training. And so Du Bois' approach, while frankly elitist, nevertheless was in its time progressive, because what he sought to do was to extend notions of racial solidarity and racial uplift to the masses of oppressed black people. But by the middle of the 20th century, Dr. Du Bois recognized that the African-American petty bourgeoisie, in many respects, is the one class that has assimilated many of the capitalist values, the dominant values of the larger society, and that a number of these African-Americans, while racially black, ideologically defect to the structure of white power and privilege. Clarence Thomas, for example, is phenotypically black, but arguably, ideologically, he is the whitest man in America today. He's arguably to the right of Trent Lott, which is going some. So you can't simply base your politics the way liberal integrationists have done on, you know, if you asked liberal integrationists 40 years ago what they want, what does the Negro want? That was the question, wasn't it? It was answered this way, a black face in a high place. We want somebody who looks like us in a position of power. Well, you've got it with Condoleezza Rice, but in effect, there is no race-based loyalty from Condi Rice, certainly not on affirmative action, where she equivocated, and lacking the integrity even of Colin Powell, who stuck to his guns and said the truth. That is, that racial preferences are no quotas, that rather preferences are necessary corrective tools to address structural racism and the debilitating, historically constructed, accumulated racist disadvantage that black and brown people operate under in the society. And so I call Condi Rice and I call Clarence Thomas race traitors. That is, they are traitors to the history of struggle of black people. They are traitors to their connectedness to the African-American community. And I argue that black people simply can't have race-conscious or color-conscious unity in a period of neoliberalism and globalization, because there could be no unity with Buthelezi in South Africa and Mobutu in the Congo. Can we expect unity, race-based unity, simplified unity based on color, with Condoleezza Rice and Clarence Thomas? I don't think so.
Manning, in your eyes, how does the movement, of course you noticed there in Washington, D.C. earlier this, last year in August, they had a march for reparations. How does the movement for reparations, the hip-hop revolution, fit into this development of what I see you looking for as true democracy in America?
That's right. I think to some extent my strategy is kind of a Fanonist strategy. That is, I said that the struggle for democracy can't be won from the top down. It has to be won from the bottom up. And in the second half of the book, I try to lay out different sites of resistance. One of those sites is the struggle for reparations. First, we have to define the word properly. Reparations simply means to repair or to make whole again. It argues that there is a difference between guilt versus responsibility. Most Americans, regardless of race, are not guilty of placing 120,000 Japanese Americans in internment camps during World War II. The Supreme Court validated that in a 1943 court case decision of the Supreme Court. The government placed Japanese Americans in these internment camps. Nevertheless, we are, as citizens, responsible for compensating the survivors and the descendants of that forced internment. Similarly, most Americans were not alive. They're not guilty of destroying Native American culture and families, carrying out genocidal wars, destroying treaties, and violating treaty agreements between the U.S. government and Native Americans. Nevertheless, we are, as American citizens, black as well as white, responsible for compensating Native Americans for the crime of genocide. The same argument logically extends to African Americans. Now, American citizens, white people today who are alive today, are not guilty of enslaving anybody. Most of them are not guilty of carrying out the policies of Jim Crow segregation. Nevertheless, they are responsible as citizens for addressing the historically constructed, accumulated racial disadvantage that the structure of white prejudice, power, and privilege has imposed on the African-American community, and we can measure through social science research the vast disparities between black and white. Fact is, as John Powell, the great law professor at the University of Minnesota, has pointed out, when white folk who are baby boomers, that is, people born between 1946 to 1964, when they die, they will bequeath to their children in $2,000, using the figure for the year 2000, they will bequeath $7 trillion of equity to their children. When black baby boomers die, born between 46 to 64, we will bequeath debt. We are in a hole we will never get out of. As I said, one-third of all black households in this country have a negative net wealth. And that's not because we didn't work hard. Because if hard work were commensurate with financial gain, black people would be among the wealthiest nations on earth. You exploit people for 246 years of unpaid labor power exploitation. If you underpay them through systems of Jim Crow and racialized hiring hierarchies, as you do today, even though the signs reading white and colored have been taken down, then you charge the state, you charge the government for creating laws of inequality through which historically constructed disadvantage was produced. And so consequently, white citizens need to understand that while they're not guilty of enslaving anybody, they are responsible and they do benefit from the structure of white privilege that does exist and that was carried out by this government. That's why in Durban, at the World Conference on Racism, the U.S. government did not want to admit that slavery was a crime against humanity, even though clearly it was and is, and its legacy lives on today, as you can see, through the inequalities based on race that we see around us every day.
Now, can you talk about the hip-hop revolution?
Oh, yes. As I said earlier, in June of 2002, Benjamin Muhammad, formerly Benjamin Chavis, Russell Simmons, and a whole panoply of hip-hop artists came together here in Manhattan to protest the Bloomberg administration's budget cuts for public education. I show in The Great Wells of Democracy that hip-hop has the potential for being a cultural template for the construction of a new activist kind of leadership. Now, this is not a new thesis. People have been saying this. You go back to the old school, listening to, say, The Message from Grandmaster Flash and The Furious Five, or Afrika Bambaataa. They were saying the same thing. So was Chuck D and P.E., Public Enemy. Today, you have Mos Def, KRS-One, Dead Prez, a whole series of artists who are raptivists, who are involved in community change and active organizing, who are involved in voter registration and education through Rap the Vote, who are involved in organizing against drugs in our community and finding ways to educate young people about HIV/AIDS, so that these are embryonic models of new forms of leadership activism. And through Columbia University, through the Institute for Research in African American Studies, last year I did a public dialogue with Russell Simmons, and I've continued that dialogue with Russell and Danny Simmons and Minister Benjamin Muhammad about how we can utilize hip-hop music and arts education as a vehicle for political education and mobilization. I feel that the civil rights movement, the traditional mainstream civil rights movement, is really being superseded. We no longer have the We Shall Overcome generation in command. It's really going to be the hip-hop generation. We have to build new leadership around the hip-hop generation, around the issue of fighting for reparations, around the issue of developing community-based grassroots mobilizing to enhance civic capacity and involvement of folk who are working class and low-income people. And that's where the fundamental shift in the power paradigm is going to take place. It won't take place from the top down. I argue in the great wells of democracy, it's going to occur, it's already occurring from the bottom up.
Now, Reverend Sharpton has just recently announced his candidacy for president. Do you think and I'm asking you to speak for him, but in a sense I'm not, will this hip-hop impulse play a part in the next presidential election in your view?
Well, I think, first off, I have to say that I have tremendous respect and admiration for Reverend Sharpton, and I wish his campaign, his candidacy, well. I understand that most people would consider it symbolic. Nevertheless, by running for elective office, by campaigning in the primaries, he will do the African-American community and progressives left of center in the Democratic Party a tremendous service. Because he is raising, he's the only candidate who's raising consistently issues of social justice that need to be raised in the 2004 election. Beyond that, however, what I argue in my book, The Great Wells of Democracy, is that in the strategy of the left generally is focused on the development or trying to create an independent party to the left of the Democrats and the Republicans. And I try to show how, even though this effort is a noble one, it is so incredibly difficult to transform America's political system because of the winner-take-all electoral system, the electoral college, the structure of money that is used that really controls electoral outcomes, gerrymandering of electoral districts. There probably aren't more than 40 competitive congressional districts out of the 400 plus electoral districts congressional districts in the United States, 435 districts, so that it becomes extremely difficult utilizing the presidential electoral route, as Ralph Nader discovered, to really have a meaningful impact on the public discourse. So I argue, along with Lonnie Guinier, that we have to move from the idea that change at the top is going to electing a good person or a progressive person like Ralph Nader or Al Sharpton into the presidency will in some way magically change the structure. I know they don't believe that, but our tendency is to focus too heavily on electoralism. We have to relearn the lessons we used to know during the period of the Black Freedom Movement of the 60s and 70s, and that is that we have to change the rules of the electoral game. We need to fight for proportional representation voting. And I know that's going to be difficult to achieve, so as an interim step, I would favor instant runoff voting, IRG, which allows us to vote for third-party candidates that we like without electing the right-wing Republicans that we don't like, so that there are different ways that we could change the voting structure that would not require constitutional amendments, that would increase voter turnout. We could also change the laws that say, instead of voting on a Tuesday or work day, vote, as in many Western democracies do, on a Sunday or over a weekend, so that you want to find ways to increase the size of the electorate. If we win this battle to re-enfranchise those who have been disfranchised by felony convictions, you could add another 4.5 to 5 million voters across the board who are disproportionately black, brown, and poor. That would definitely have a change in the electoral results in 2004 election. So these are strategies, I think, that could meaningfully change the political system that aren't necessarily running a symbolic candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination.
Manning, did Jesse Jackson miss his historical imperative, and that is to create a true third party?
Jackson's Rainbow Coalition always had two tendencies in it. There was a tendency that was represented in many ways by Ron Brown, who was Jesse's formal campaign manager in 1988 during his second campaign, and a progressive tendency that was represented by Ron Daniels, who's now the head of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and for those progressives who worked with Jesse, such as Ron Dellums and others. The Jackson campaign was, in a way, at its best in 1984 rather than 88, because it was an insurgent campaign. It was an effort to challenge Reaganism by creating a social movement within the Democratic Party to mobilize voters, to raise progressive issues, in some respects what Al Sharpton is trying to do in 2004. In 1988, the shift occurred because Jesse actually believed he could win the nomination. And when you're running a campaign that should be a social movement, it can be fatally flawed if the candidate believes, no, it's not for making principled political points, but it's for electing myself to public office. Then that's when you have the danger of compromising and compromises and contradictions. And that inevitably occurred in 1988. 1989, Jesse then made demands within the Rainbow to be able to appoint state chairs of the Rainbow. And as some of the listeners will recall, that this led to a vast exodus of most left and progressive and feminist and gay and lesbian activists who had worked hard, donated hundreds of thousands of hours of time to the Rainbow campaign of 1988, it largely fell apart. The Rainbow still does exist. There are many activists who work closely with Reverend Jackson. I have tremendous respect for Jesse Jackson as a person. But in terms of his political leadership, his failure to consolidate the Rainbow outside of the Democratic Party proved fatal. And so by the early 1990s, it had ceased to exist as a meaningful political force pressure group within the Democratic Party.
Manning, as we move towards the end of this interview, there's also a section in your book that talks about how we have been affected in terms of racism after 9/11.
Well, the Great Wells of Democracy, the chapter, the penultimate chapter, is racism in the time of terror. And in the wake of 9/11, what I tried to do was interpret 9/11 from the standpoint of the African-American community. We saw higher rates of unemployment. We saw racial profiling, religious and ethnic profiling throughout the country. We saw the unequal access to resources and government benefits as they were meted out here in Manhattan and across the country as the victims of 9/11, that racialized minorities got the short end of the stick. So I describe in great detail the dynamics, the repercussions of the terrorist attacks of 9/11 upon the African-American community. I try to make a strong point that terror is a tool that only reinforces the right wing. That is, there is no political position, there is no justification for the use of extreme violence or lethal force against the civilian population. That's what terror is. Now, the reason that I can define it so easily and quickly is because we live in a country that has carried out mass terror against its own population, certainly against Native Americans, certainly the 5,000 black people lynched in this country, the 5,500 from 1880 to 1930, that merits as terrorism, that is the use of deadly force outside of the law to terrorize, to intimidate a community. The same kind of criminal state terrorism was utilized by the American government, I point out in my book, in Chile in September 1973. The thousands of people who were murdered, raped, who were brutalized by the Chilean dictatorship of Salvador Allende, of Augusto Pinochet, the destruction of a democratically elected government of Salvador Allende, that was carried out, financed, and directed by the CIA. So that I point out that Osama bin Laden and Henry Kissinger and Augusto Pinochet all have a common denominator. They are quite literally have the same kind of bankrupt morals or the lack of morals because they utilize terror against civilian populations.
Manning, and I'm going to end with or ask these last two questions, going back to the beginning of the book. What are the possibilities for a new social contract between the people, the state, based on fairness and real equality under the law?
My last chapter in The Great Wells of Democracy is entitled The Souls of White Folk. And that's the big question. Can white people overcome their whiteness, their tendency to white out issues, to avoid, evade, defer? Can they confront the history, the historic truth of the American experience, which truly is a struggle for freedom that has been embodied and articulated best by those who have been denied the most freedom, people of African descent, Native Americans, and others? And so a new negotiation has to take place about the nature of the democratic project. That's what King meant by the phrase, the great wells of democracy. Dr. Du Bois argued at the end of his life that we have to envision a democracy that transcends those historic commitments to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. What about the right not to go hungry in a land of agricultural abundance? Or the right to medical care as a human right? 45 million Americans, as I speak now, today, lack medical care. 500,000 Americans will be turned away this year from emergency rooms and clinics because they have no health insurance. That's, to me, not a democracy that speaks meaningfully to the material conditions of millions and millions of people, and not just those of African descent. So what we are struggling for is an unfinished democratic revolution. What we're struggling for at the global level is a struggle against global apartheid, the racialized inequality that separates the haves from the have-nots, utilizing the phrase from Malcolm X at the end of his life. So the Great Wells of Democracy is a challenge. It's an effort to articulate, to express one African-American person's journey through the post-civil rights era, looking and examining different sites of racism and resistance. For example, in the community chapter, I go into Cincinnati's Over the Rhine community, sat down and talk with activists and those who are involved in the boycott against the business district, business community in that city. I try to show that there are tremendous signs of hope and resistance all over this country. The hip-hop generation in faith-based communities and faith-based institutions, among women and single parents, struggles around foster care, struggles around employment, struggles for against homelessness and hunger. So that new resistance movement is crystallizing all over the country. It doesn't get the headlines. It